Les colloques du Collège de France.
Welcome to the last session of the symposium about the links between geodynamics and long-term climate changes. And you have the program here, and we will go on afterward with different speakers, Christelle Chanard from the IGN and IPGP in Paris, Emmanuel Pucea from the University of Dijon, and Bärbel Önisch from Lamont at Columbia University in New York, and finally Dan Lund from the University of Bristol. So my introduction, it will be quite simple-minded. I entitled that historical perspective to the geological forcings of climate. And so during the first session of the symposium yesterday, we heard about the differences between rocky planets such as Earth, Venus, Mars, and Mercury in terms of tectonic activity, volcanism, greenhouse gas concentration. We then heard about geodynamics and magma generation at volcanic belts and mid-ocean ridges. So as an introduction to deep time climate variation, I will provide a brief and non-exhaustive historical perspective on the field. I will go back, in fact, to some of the early pioneers of geology and geophysics. And so we will see that these scholars were interested in both physics, chemistry, as well as in geology and past environment. And so most of these early scientists are very well known to this audience and to you, but I will also focus on contributions that are completely ignored, or at least completely underappreciated in the geology and in the climatology communities. And this will also allow me to start with Xavier Le Pichon, who deserves, in fact, to be a place among these pioneering figures of the field. So this is the slide I showed yesterday for the introduction of the symposium. And as you know, in 1986, Xavier Le Pichon was appointed professor at the Collège de France, where he held the chair of geodynamics until 2008. So on this slide, you can see a few photographs of Xavier. On the top, in the 70s, at the time of the expedition FAMOS, French-American Mid-Ocean Undersea Survey. On the left, you see Xavier looking at rocks brought back aboard a research vessel. And on the right, you see him standing on the Nojima Fault, close to Kobe in Japan. So what people don't know usually is that Xavier cut his teeth in physical oceanography when he started at Lamont. At that time, it was the Lamont-Doherty Observatory. The Lamont Observatory, Geological Observatory, not the Lamont-Doherty Geological Observatory. And so this is from one of his very early papers published in GJR in 1960 about the deep water circulation of the Indian Ocean, and where he was studying, in fact, the movement of water masses at depth. And at these great depths, the water masses are disturbed by the topography of the seafloor, which is not mentioned, in fact, in the paper, but probably this may have had an influence on his career looking at the seafloor itself. And at that time, oceanographers, and still today, oceanographers and geologists often took part in the same campaigns at sea, especially at that time it was on the Vima at Lamont. And what you can see on this graph is a typical classical temperature salinity diagrams that are defining, in fact, the isopycnols, the lines of isodensity to understand the movement and the mixing of ocean water masses. So this was an early work by Xavier in 1960. And I will show again this slide that we have seen at several times during the symposium. This is from his seminal 1968 paper entitled Seafloor Spreading and Continental Drift. So it remains a founding milestone with a quantitative model of seafloor spreading with six plates. So Xavier Le Pichon, as I said, was here teaching at the Collège de France, and he had his lab at the ENS very close by. But Xavier was not the first geologist at the Collège de France interested in global tectonics. Especially in the 19th century, the most prominent professor of geology was Léonce-Élie de Beaumont. His main interest was in the formation of mountains, and he was really looking at regularity, was searching for regularity at the surface of the Earth at the global scale. And he also conducted himself some fieldwork because he was very much involved in the, producing the geological map of France. And so this is, for example, from his book published in 1830, a few outcrops from the south of France, close to, not very far from Sisteron, actually. So Élie Beaumont was doing fieldwork himself, and he was really looking for regularity, especially in the Alps. And so this is a map taken from his work, published in 1830, where he is also using the work of other geologists of the time. So he was relying, for example, for this work, for example, you can see, I mean, it's difficult for you to read, but the citations are directly on the map, and the colors are published in the book. For example, here, for these east-west lines in the Alps, he's citing the famous geologist Leopold von Buch from in Germany, and for the north-south ones that are here in green, he's citing the work, I mean, it says, see the work by Mr. De Saussure from Geneva. So he's citing, in fact, the work of other people, and he's trying to simplify to get regularity and especially lines. He was looking for geometric figures at the surface of the Earth. And so in the 19th century, it was much before, of course, plate tectonics and even continental drift. The Earth was thought to cool and shrink through time, like the image that was used by several authors was that the Earth was behaving like a drying apple whose skin wrinkles and the interior is contracting, so it creates, in fact, ridges at the surface. And Élie de Beaumont developed he was well trained in mathematics, and he was really trying to look at a geometrical feature at the surface of the Earth. Especially, he built, in fact, he thought that the mountains were organized in a pentagonal network at the surface of the Earth. So these are two graphs from one of his papers. This is a projection on the plane, and this is a globe that is at the Collège de France. Unfortunately, it was, I mean, for a long time, it was in the room next door, but it was moved to another building of the Collège de France, the Rue Cardinal Lemoine, so I can't show it to you. And it has all the pentagons that, in relation with the mountains, ranges, that Élie Beaumont was studying. So Élie Beaumont was really belonging, in fact, to the contractionist tectonic scholars, and which was combined with an extreme geometrical fixism. So he was really looking at very exact regularity at the on the Earth. So I mentioned him because he was quite important at the Collège de France, and especially this globe was with us for a long time period. And he was citing other scientists, especially geologists. And I mentioned, in fact, the fact that Élie de Beaumont really admired, in fact, and cited a lot the work by Saussure, by Horace Benedict de Saussure, who was born in Geneva, and he lived most of his life in Geneva. At that time, Geneva was an independent town. It was then French, and then it joined in the 19th century Switzerland. But at that time, it was in the French-speaking part of... he was in Geneva, and he... Saussure was really a polymath. He was interested in physics, and he was also a naturalist. He did many things, and but he really did some precise observation in the Alps. And at the same time, he had a new concept that he explained. That was the deformation by compression through horizontal displacement in opposite direction to produce, in fact, mountain gradients, which was quite new. Instead of having only vertical movements, he was mentioning horizontal movement. And so Saussure was also fascinated, in fact, by mountain, especially the Mont Blanc. I mean, he was the second person to climb on the Mont Blanc in 1787. So the reason why I'm mentioning Saussure is connected again with Elie de Beaumont and the Collège de France, but at the same time, because we will speak, I mentioned greenhouse effect and long-term climate changes. The other thing that Saussure did was he did the first experiments on the greenhouse effect. And he built, in fact, actually a greenhouse, or more or less a solar panel, which is shown here. This is a reproduction with basically it had in that case three boxes that were closed by glass panes and with thermometers in the different boxes. He called this device a heliothermometer. And this was the intention was to capture, in fact, the incident solar radiation and to trap the induced infrared radiation in the box, in the inner box, and he obtained temperatures up to 150 degrees. I mean, he's even mentioning, in fact, some application for that, for cooking or for boiling water. What was also interesting is that most of his work about this heliothermometer and all the experiments are explained and well described in one paper that is quite long, which is published in the Journal de Paris. I mean, you can't invent that. I mean, 1784. And he was not using the greenhouse analogy, he was using the carrosse or coach or carriage in English, because people at that time were annoyed, in fact, it was a serious discomfort at that time to have a too high temperature, especially during the summer, in this carrosse, in these coaches. And so this is where in the paper is mentioning the carrosse. So so he understood, in fact, that there was an asymmetry between the two different radiation, the one that comes from the sun and the one that is emitted by the box. But he did not fully understand other experiments that he conducted. For example, he put his device in front of a fireplace to emitting infrared, and he did not understand why it was not behaving as he expected. And it was because, in fact, the glass is not transmitting infrared. But he realized that there was a difference, a fundamental difference between the two types of radiation. This is what he wrote. Difference lies between the propagation of heat itself and that of light. For also, flame is luminous. It heats incomparably more by heat than by light. So he already had a hint that something was different between the two radiation. But the main person who did the work to discover, in fact, the infrared was William Herschel, or Wilhelm, because he came from Germany as a musician when he immigrated to England. But then he moved to astronomy. I mean, he discovered, for example, the planet Uranus. And but William Herschel is also credited for the discovery of infrared radiation. And he understood, in fact, the difference and at the same time the similarity between the incoming visible light and the infrared. So these are a few plates from his work. I mean, this is a very long title in the Philosophical Transaction. And he was using for different optical system to look at the infrared, either coming from a fireplace or from a block of iron that is heated. So he really understood that there were two different radiation. But the main pioneer who really understood the greenhouse effect and is credited for that is Joseph Fourier. And what he understood, and this is in one sentence the basics of the fundamentals of the greenhouse effect, is the asymmetry between the transmission of the radiation. The atmosphere is transparent to visible light, but it absorbs infrared radiation from the Earth. And this is this asymmetry that produces the greenhouse warming. And I mean, I won't read everything, but there are a few things that are quite impressive. I mean, for example, if you read this sentence, the sun's heat arriving in the form of light has the property of penetrating transparent solid or liquid substances and loses it almost entirely when it is converted through its transmission to terrestrial bodies into dark radiant heat, la chaleur obscure. This distinction between luminous heat and dark heat explains the temperature rise caused by transparent bodies. And he went on, even by interpreting correctly in that case the heliothermometer. So this is what he says. The theory of Mr. de Saussure heliothermometer is easy to understand. The acquired heat is concentrated because it is not immediately dissipated by the air renewal. So that's the very important to take into account. But then he went on by saying the heat thus transmitted ceases to be luminous. It retains only the common properties of dark radiant heat. In this state, it cannot pass through the glass plates that cover the container. It accumulates more and more in the container enveloped in a weakly conducting material, and the temperature rises until the incoming heat is exactly compensated by that which dissipates. So he understood, in fact, this equilibrium temperature. It is necessary to consider carefully this order of facts and the results of the calculation when one wants to know the influence of the atmosphere and waters on the thermometric state of the Earth. At exactly the same time, there were geologists, 19th century paleontologists, that discovered, in fact, reptiles, for example, dinosaurs. The very same year, William Buckland, for example, published his first paper on the first dinosaur, the Megalosaurus. The following year, in 1825, it was the iguanodon that was described by Gideon Mantel. And in France, there was a famous fight at the French Academy between Georges Cuvier and Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire about the evolution and basically linked to crocodile species that were found in Caen. But the bottom line is that everybody was aware that at that time, Cretaceous and Jurassic time period, the Earth was warmer at our latitudes. The information also came from the fossils found in coal, in carboniferous levels. For example, this is a slide showing fossils of giant trees from the carboniferous, where you can see Pecopteris, Sigillaria, Calamites. You have this Glasgow stump, fossil stumps that are quite famous. So people were aware that during this time period, the climate could be much warmer than today. So the geologists of the time were trying to find explanation for that. And because they were naturalists, you had people doing physics, chemistry, and geology or paleontology, and they all exchanged together information. For example, this is from the famous book of Charles Lyell. Charles Lyell was trying to explain, in fact, the changes of climate during that time period by moving continents. I mean, not moving them, but it was more or less linked to variation, vertical movement of the crust. And he was putting the continents as they are, for example, here, but maintaining, in fact, the surface of the continents. It was not meant to move the continents. It was just meant to show that a different configuration could lead to different climate on the continent. So this is the configuration that he hypothesized for the extreme of heat, and this is the symmetric one that he that was explaining for him the extreme of cold in the past, especially glaciation in the past. Some other scholars were also looking at other explanation, especially changes of the chemistry of the atmosphere. And one of the key pioneers about this, and the first to propose that changes in the carbon cycle have altered the atmospheric CO2 content and the Earth's climate, was Jacques-Joseph Ebelmann in France at the École des Mines de Paris. He was also the director of the Royal Porcelain Manufactory of Sèvres. And unfortunately, he died quite prematurely at the age of 38, but he had a time, in fact, to do many contributions in applied science, in metallurgy, and also in synthesis of minerals. He synthesized, for example, emerald, ruby, olivine, spinels. And also, he was very much interested by the carbon cycle on the long term. And he published that in two very long articles that are more or less books. And for Ebelmann, he understood that the atmospheric content of carbonic acid is maintained by a dynamic equilibrium between the emission from volcanic vents, he was calling that vents, and the decomposition of silicate. And I think, I mean, it's quite amazing when you read, in fact, the papers, and I would like to read that in front of you, because this pioneer is really underappreciated and completely forgotten. He has his name on the Eiffel Tower for his other works, but not for this contribution. So several circumstances nevertheless tend to prove that in ancient geological periods, the atmosphere was denser and richer in carbonic acid and perhaps in oxygen than it is today. Greater gravity of the gaseous envelope must have corresponded to a greater condensation of solar heat, an atmospheric phenomena of a much greater intensity. He went on by saying, nothing establishes that the various causes which tend to modify the composition of the air currently have a net effect of zero. As the composition of our atmosphere reached a permanent steady state of equilibrium, it will undoubtedly take many centuries to obtain the answer to this great question. And everything is published in 1845. I mean, you have to realize that. And the last sentence that I highlight is, I really like it. I believe that it would be of great interest to determine the quantity of carbonic acid contained in the air, which would provide the natural history of the globe with the most important piece of data for the present and especially for the future. So it's quite amazing when you see that. I mean, this is an illustrative slide, in fact, showing what, in a nutshell, what Abelman has understood. I mean, he understood the long-term thermostat of the climate of the Earth on the long term, with the compensation and the dynamic equilibrium between the CO2 outgassing from volcanic activity, either in ridges or in volcanoes, and the trapping of the CO2 by the rock weathering. And he went, I mean, very far, because he was doing chemistry, he was analyzing rocks, and he completely understood the origin of the clays, and especially the kaolinite, because the kaolinite was, after all, the main thing that they were using for the porcelain in Sèvres. So this reaction, I mean, the reaction that he ended up calculating was not for the anorthite, but for the orthoclase, so the potassium end member of feldspar. But and he did not get it completely right for the stoichiometry of the mineral, but he understood completely the evolution that the primary silicates were altered by CO2 and water and were producing ions that were going to the ocean, being trapped with carbonates, and were leaving away clay minerals. And this is the main and this is what he wrote. For example, the formation of igneous rocks is accompanied by the release of carbonic gas, which will precipitate and be fixed by the same destruction of the same rocks. So he really understood what was going on for the long term, and he had even questions about the future, and he also calculated, he made some calculation about the amount of CO2 that is needed, in fact, to produce the amount of clays, for example, present on Earth. So this is quite amazing. So he had also an idea that the timescale to produce these clays must have been quite long, although he did not calculate it because he had no way to calculate the kinetics of this reaction. So this is quite amazing that to see that it was all that it was published in 1845, and I'm not sure that we heard about Wegener during the conference. I don't think that we heard about him, but it was 70 years before Wegener and 70 years after. So the Alfred Wegener was not a geologist, he was an astronomer and meteorologist, but he was also genuinely interested in the geological past. And he understood that the continents were once in the past joined in a single supercontinent, Pangaea, and that they had drifted away over time. So on the left, you can see, in fact, the reconstruction of Pangaea from his first book on the subject, published in 1915. And on the right, he was also in the media, in the New York Times, so published in 1930. His maps were reproduced for a different time period by the New York Times. But Wegener was not only interested by the geological aspect, he was very much into also explaining the paleoclimate changes that paleontologists and geologists were reconstructing. And especially because he teamed up with his mentor and actually father-in-law, Vladimir Köppen, who was a meteorologist, a climatologist, and also a botanist. I mean, he started by doing a PhD on the effect of temperature on plant growth, but he was very much interested in the link between climate and vegetation at the global scale. So here I reproduce, in fact, taken from his book published in 1923, black and white map for the relationship between climate and vegetation. And these maps are still used today. I mean, this is, for example, taken from the FAO FAO website document, the Köppen's climate classification that is still in use today. I'm sure that, okay, we will hear about models and it's clearly superseded, but the main pioneering work by Köppen is really amazing when you see it. And Köppen and Wegener published a seminal paper in 1924, which is called the climates of the geological past, or the Klimate der geologischen Vorzeit, and which was really to study the links over time and between seafloor, continental drift, and the changes of planet environment. So these are a few pictures. These are a few maps that I took from this work by Köppen and Wegener. So you have probably seen them already. This is a reconstruction of what was going on during the Carboniferous, either for the fossils. So, for example, you will recognize that he plotted the Pecopteris that I showed you before along the equator of the time. And there were other species, especially at high latitude, where you had also areas that were covered by very ancient ice sheets producing the tillets. And the second map is showing the different paleo environments, either covered with ice sheets. You have coal at the equator, salt and gypsum, and also sandstone in the tropics. So this is really trying to get a link between global tectonics and climate of the time. So this is another picture from the same book where we can see paleoclimatal data for the Jurassic period that are superimposed on the map, where he was trying to make sense out of the evidence that were produced by the geologists of the time. So this was about what I wanted to show you about these pioneers. So it was absolutely non-exhaustive and maybe biased by my French orientation. So I have read many of these French pioneers that are really underappreciated, especially Saussure and Abelman. And it's clear that even at that time, these pioneers of geology and paleoenvironment and modern scientists, we are fully aware that to understand the long-term climatic changes, we need, in fact, to take into account that the climate is not only linked to the atmosphere. I mean, probably for all of you, it's obvious, but for meteorologists, for example, and climatologists from 50 years ago, models were only atmospheric, taking into account the atmosphere at the beginning. So now we know that we need what are called Earth system models. We need to take into account the Earth system as a whole, or the climate system as a whole, which includes very diverse compartments that are summarized on this very simplistic figure. So you have obviously the atmosphere, you have the hydrosphere, I mean the water on the Earth, the cryosphere, so the ice, you have the biosphere, and finally the lithosphere. The geology matters on a very long timescale, and I showed you that it was fully realized by Jacques-Joseph Abelman. So these compartments of the climate system, of the Earth system, they exchange matter, and they exchange heat also, and they exchange water in particular, and they can be perturbed by either external forcings, like cosmic material or gravity forces. For example, you can change, in fact, the orbital parameters that will change the climate. So, but also, you have geological forcing that is quite important. And I mentioned a few of them. And we already had seen yesterday that volcanic activity and greenhouse gases are quite important, even for other planets. So it's also the case for the Earth, and I highlighted here the geological forcings that we mentioned: volcanoes, the topography and shape of the continent, the shapes and the depths of the oceanic basins, and all that have to be taken into account, which makes the whole thing complicated. And fortunately, we have models to do that, but it means that we need to take into account different time scale. That's also one of the problematic aspects, because if we consider, in fact, changes over the long time scale, over the geological time scale, it's clear that we need to take into account geological forcings, continental drift, mountain formation, volcanoes, but at the same time, when we study a particular record, it is affected also by short-term changes. It can be, so you need, in fact, to have an idea about changes of the seasonal cycle, and if the record is representing one season or the other, even for the deep past, so it makes the whole thing complicated. So this is a graphical and very simplistic diagram summarizing that with different characteristic time constants, and you have a few examples of climatic variations. And of course, over the recent past, over the last century, we have humans that are adding another anthropogenic forcing, which is, by the way, geology, because basically what we are doing since more than a century is to destroy a major geological component of the carbon cycle, namely the fossil fuels, including coal and oil deposits that took millions of years to form. But as we will see during the afternoon, in fact, climates over the geological past provide us with situations that were very different from today, very exotic climates. So it allows us to test the same models that are used to predict the future. So this is the interest, and stay tuned for the competent colleagues that will speak after me. And just as a last slide, I hope that this is one of the major, one of the main figure of the IPCC, last report of the IPCC, AR6. And the importance of considering paleoclimate variation in the context of the present global warming is fully realized by the community working on modern and global warming happening today and in the future. So this can be illustrated by this IPCC timeline that is summarizing, in fact, the most important key steps in documenting climate changes on the upper part of the diagram, and in understanding the greenhouse effect. So, for example, you have it starts with Fourier. I mean, it should be corrected. It's not 1820. I mean, it should be 1824 for the main study of the greenhouse. But this timeline should be definitely updated with the inclusion of De Saussure. I hope that I convince you, or you can go back to the Journal de Paris, for example, if you want to have more details about it, in 1784, about the first experiment on the greenhouse effect, or the Koch effect, or the Karros effect. And in 1845, the first suggestion that CO2 warmed the planet in the past, in the geological past, and also the first description of the geological carbon cycle over a very long time scale. So this is where I will end, and I hope that I succeeded in mentioning, in fact, the different key elements that will be discussed more precisely with modern science by the colleagues that will follow on now with the program. Thank you very much for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.